the engineering and political challenge of decarbonization is so massive that it requires a degree of political will and commitment of resources and everything that is also lacking. So it's kind of like we have this information war, which is the thing that you're kind of criticizing in your article, Holly, which fills the space where political will would be.
Yeah, that's what I found so interesting about this particular moment when we did have, for the first time in a while, significant capital in the US context with legislation around infrastructure. It's like, okay, now we have some funds, we can go build the stuff. And then why was the discussion, at least the most high-profile discussion, really focusing on the evil oil companies when actually this is a moment that we could seize and think seriously about the roadmap for how do we capitalize on this initial investment to try to drive further investments down the line?
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to BungaCast, the global politics podcast at the end of history. I'm Alex Hokuli in São Paulo, Brazil, as usual. And today joining me is regular contributor Lee Phillips, who's producing this session, and also delighted to be joined by Holly Jean Buck, who's assistant professor of environment and sustainability at the University of Buffalo in New York. Hi, Holly.
Hello.
Hi, thanks for joining us. So today we're talking about climate disinformation. I'm going to say a little word about that very in just a second. To just continue introducing Holly, her first book was After Geoengineering, Climate Tragedy, Repair and Restoration, which explores best and worst case scenarios for climate intervention. And her latest book, also published by Verso, is Ending Fossil Fuels, Why Net Zero is Not Enough, which investigates the concept of net zero and negative emissions technologies. We're going to get into a bit of that as well as we go along today. But first of all, a few weeks ago, Jacobin published an essay by Holly critiquing the climate movement's emphasis on combating disinformation. I'm going to quote from the stand first here. Much of the climate movement is now pouring its energies into combating disinformation. But this focus fails to address real concerns about a green transition and obscures what is needed to win the public over to effective climate action. The essay seems to have caused a stir on, I guess, climate Twitter, but also far beyond just activists. And it hit a nerve with, I guess, some people feeling like it really said something they had on their minds but hadn't expressed yet, while it drew outrage from other quarters. Maybe just one final kind of contextual note before we probably get started and bring Holly in. This is all in the context, I think, as listeners will probably know as well, of a growing focus from authorities on combating disinformation in general, not just in relation to climate. So I believe that this conversation, or I'm looking forward to hearing from Holly, perhaps how this question of disinformation and the focus on combating it in relation to climate might have relevance to other questions of political communication, information war, and actually to quite deep questions about whether we understand politics as a matter of competing interests, competing material interests, if it's about ethics or if it's about something else entirely. So I'd like to bring Holly in now and stop blathering. Your training is in sociology, Holly, but you've specialized in aspects of politics and society around questions of geoengineering, in particular solar radiation management, carbon capture and storage, and carbon dioxide removal, and other decarbonization technologies. So I don't know what most of those terms mean, or maybe I could have a sense of what they are, but wouldn't be able to give you a good definition. So maybe you can help us out just to set us up with the terms that we might need for this discussion, Holly.
So I've been thinking about geoengineering for about 15 years now. And the reason I got interested in that concept is that I was concerned about climate change and concerned that we weren't making enough progress quickly enough, basically. So at the climate change conference in Copenhagen, many years ago now, there's this global summit, and there were these side events about solar geoengineering, which is technologies that would block a fraction of incoming sunlight and reflect it back to space to cool the Earth, as well as carbon removal, which is technologies that would draw CO2 that's already been emitted into the atmosphere, out of the atmosphere, and store it somewhere else. So, you know, that's where I started my career, thinking about the politics, the social considerations, the ethical considerations of those technologies. And then more recently, I've been writing about fossil fuel phase out and really decarbonization, which I think should be our primary focus.
Excellent. Well, we want to get on, I guess, immediately, and we'll double back to some of these other questions later on, but we want to get on to immediately the meat of your argument. So what is disinformation and or misinformation in the climate context, and why, maybe by extension, do you think your essay proved so explosive?
So there are a few reasons why I wanted to write that essay. And I guess the first is that for the past couple of years, I've been working on an empirical research project, learning what people in the United States think about net zero policies and goals. So I've traveled to several different regions of the U.S. and done interviews and focus groups. We're also doing a survey, just getting into how people working on climate are approaching what we need to do to curb warming, and what people in the public who haven't heard much about net zero or these other goals think. And so, you know, increasingly through those conversations, I became aware that there's all these people obviously working on climate change on the ground, and they're doing things that might not get a lot of attention. They're helping local municipalities apply for money that's in the Inflation Reduction Act or the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, trying to mobilize those federal incentives, or they are working on local planning for adaptation and cooling centers and thinking about how to move culverts or whatever sort of built infrastructure in their town to deal with increased flooding. There's all these sorts of people doing these jobs all over the country. And they're not really hooked in always to this national, I would characterize as pretty online climate movement, where there are obviously some NGOs that bridge this gap that have a structure where they have local chapters like the Sierra Club. But there's this online wing of the movement that's pretty influential in journalism and in political discourse that seems disconnected from these people on the ground who are using really different strategies and language to try to reach people. And so I was witnessing this disconnect and observing that this turn that the online intellectual wing of the climate movement has been making towards focusing on disinformation, towards combating the fossil fuel industry. You know, I agree with actually a lot of what they're doing, but I find it counterproductive from the point of view of helping those people on the ground who are trying to work often in rural areas and red states. That language of disinformation is not going to help them further what they're trying to do. Mm. So that was kind of the driving motivation to talk about this disconnect and think about what we should be focusing on instead of disinformation.
So the outset of the article you wrote for Jacobin just over a week ago, you mentioned that anti-climate disinformation legislation had passed in Canada just this June, and that there have also been hearings in the U.S. Congress about the same subject. So could you walk us through exactly what's been going on, not just in terms of the extremely online focus or the activist focus on disinformation? This is a serious topic that at sort of high levels of government as well, isn't it?
Yeah. And so, I mean, within the U.S. context, the congressional hearings, I do think a lot of that was kind of driven by the online wing and the appetite to, you know, hold fossil fuel companies accountable, which I fundamentally understand at a deep level. But a lot of it was kind of performance-based and trying to muster this wider base, but not like the wider base in terms of both parties or the whole country really speaking to this leftist base and saying, hey, we're doing something, we're having this hearing, we're putting attention on this. And then in Canada with the anti-greenwashing law, I thought that was an interesting move. I think there's been, other sorts of legal moves to bring legislation into combating certain sorts of claims. And so it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But it's part of a broader context, I think. And, you're in Brazil, you might have some insight into this that I don't have about trying to combat disinformation with legal maneuvers or other sorts of policy challenges. And so there's a wider landscape there that people who don't follow climate are sensitized to.
What exactly is so bad about combating disinformation on climate or on any topic? Surely there are bad ideas out there. They need to be argued against. Some of the responses from people like David Roberts, the climate podcaster, and Gunther, their argument is that there is this massive multi-million dollar campaign by big oil and big auto. What's wrong with combating those bad ideas? Or is this not really what's going on?
The second question is interesting, but to get to your first question about what's wrong with it. So, to some extent, I think it's a deflection of attention, but I don't even think that's the main problem. The main problem is really that this frame of disinformation leads us in the wrong direction. So I think there's three risks with taking that as the frame of what we're doing. One, we could be opening the door to this regime of censorship in a way, because it sets up the problem of, okay, who really decides what's disinformation and what's not, what's true and what's not. It might feel at first glance like that's obvious, but actually there's a lot of areas where it's not so obvious. And we might end up in a place where those people on quote unquote our side are actually don't end up being the ones in control of that institution that's making those arbitrations. And I think that's a dangerous place that we don't want to be in. So that's one issue. I also think that we can end up reinforcing the power of the fossil fuel industry when we're really focusing on, their evil campaigns or whatever. And I think that there's a form of left conspiratorialism. I don't know the exact word, but you can see how this manifests in a bunch of different topics that we need to be wary of. It's not everything is a plot of the fossil fuel industry, and there's just really simple material reasons why it's hard to get off of fossil fuels. The disinformation thing is really just icing on the cake, and we don't want to just be focusing on the icing, right?
I wondered whether because I think there's a, does it express a naivety in a way, the idea that for example the fossil fuel industry might not pursue its interests? That effectively an understanding of any issue is a world of competing interests, right? Of competing different interest groups, different sectors, different industries, et cetera, who might have kind of conflicting interests, and that therefore their communications will reflect that. Do you think that there's a kind of, a sort of a confluence between what you just described as, a kind of conspiratorial mindset and a certain naivety about other people are going to go look after what their interests are?
Yeah, I think so. Although one thing I heard a lot from people, because I pointed out that, in all my conversations with the public, they don't trust anything the fossil fuel industry says. It's not like they're being convinced by whatever misinformation. But then people say, well, it's not direct. It's not about what the company is actually saying. It's about them secretly funding some front group that pretends to be a community group that's actually doing their bidding. And it's kind of through these circuitous routes that the disinformation happens. And I do think that there's a couple of examples of that, but I don't think it's the main thing that's going on in climate action by any means. And so to focus too much on that would be a misdiagnosis of the situation.
So this sort of fits back into something that, I mean, myself, I've been thinking about relatively recently, about how the theory of change of sort of two groups of people within the sort of climate space, where one group of people would argue that decarbonization is just fundamentally very easy. All of our tools, all of the technologies we need to do this are basically already there. And largely the only reason that we're not decarbonizing fast enough is this disinformation campaign, the efforts of big oil and big auto and so on, so forth to postpone decarbonization. And then there's another group of people who would argue that actually decarbonization is very, very difficult on an engineering basis, on an infrastructural basis, on a biochemical basis. And this may well, that however difficult it is, however difficult it already is, it may well be delayed by efforts by fossil fuel companies and auto companies and so on. But ultimately, this is one of the most difficult tasks that we've ever engaged in as a civilization. Where do you fall between those two sort of camps? Or am I not sort of describing the two camps well enough?
I think that's a great way to describe it. I'm definitely in the latter camp, but I have to be empathetic when I think about how long it took me to get there. So I wasn't a scientist. I didn't know about energy systems 10, 15 years ago. I had to go through a process of thinking about the challenge and learning about fertilizer production and the interconnection queue and transmission and all of these different topics before I understood really the scope of the challenge. And so I don't blame people who don't have a background in this and are just concerned citizens out there who think, oh, well, we just need to use more renewables and everything exists and we just need to do it. Like, it's an understandable position to be in. And then I think, okay, well, as an academic, where have we gone wrong with teaching people about the nature of this challenge?
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me, you know, if you think of something like Just Stop Oil, I mean, like, the both in terms of their practice and even just in their name, it sounds like, you know, if you stamp your feet hard enough, that it'll resolve the issue, right? That it's really just a question of political will. But it seems to me that there's a problem of political will on all sides. I mean, this goes beyond climate, of course, but the problem of will generation is difficult. So the climate activists have an issue in terms of saying, well, you know, they have to resort to civil disobedience and to kind of tactics which are often alienating, but are attention grabbing, like Just Stop Oil, and even again the name just saying Just Stop Oil as a way to kind of generate the will necessary. But at the same time, I think I'm you know, convinced by the way that Lee portrayed it in terms of the engineering and political challenge of decarbonization is so massive that it requires a degree of political will and kind of commitment of resources and everything that is also lacking. So it's kind of like, it feels like we have this information war, which is the thing that you're kind of criticizing in your article, Holly, which fills the space where, you know, kind of political will would be.
Yeah, that's what I found so interesting about this particular moment when we did have, for the first time in a while, significant capital in the U.S. context with these two pieces of legislation around infrastructure. It's like, okay, now we have some funds, we can go build the stuff. And then why was the discussion, at least the most high profile discussion, really focusing on the evil oil companies, when actually this is a moment that we could seize and think seriously about the roadmap for, you know, how do we capitalize on this initial investment to try to drive further investments down the line?
Talking about sort of driving those investments and the people involved on the ground at a sort of municipal or state level, and your own research, reaching out to these people and interviewing them and what they think about things. Now, one of the things that really struck me was in your essay was that you'd said that they just aren't taken in by the fossil fuel so-called disinformation campaigns, and that this is a kind of elitist condescension to assume that ordinary people will always just by whatever the ad men are selling them. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about your research along these lines and what you found about them as quote unquote victims of misinformation.
Yeah, it was striking to me how fed up people are, not just with fossil fuel companies, but basically big ag, basically any type of large corporation. And I found this even more so in areas like Oklahoma or West Virginia or parts of the country that have, you know, already felt material harms from fossil fuel extraction. Even though those are where jobs are, people are pretty clear-eyed about the trade-offs involved and not thrilled about industry claims, right? So this idea that, you know, the fossil fuel companies are just disinforming them, that's clearly not what's going on. And yet people do say wacky things sometimes, you know, around the impacts of solar panels, like, you know, are they giving off radiation? Are they changing the atmosphere? Like, out of the wall things, you hear that from time to time. So I'm not saying that there's no problem with our media ecosystem, but it's like, if we want to fix the media ecosystem, like this disinformation frame is one we inherited, A, from like the KGB, but B, it's one that's been embraced by big tech and Meta and, you know, these other companies are pretty happy for us to run with this idea of disinformation, because that's just like, okay, it's the bad apples. It's just the bad stuff. We've got to filter it out. And we're not forming a critique of the structure of these platforms or this whole media ecosystem. So,
yeah, well, and it seems like institutions beyond, you know, the kind of big corporations that you cited are the objects of deep mistrust. I mean, it's like a legitimacy crisis across the board. And it seems like, I mean, I wonder what you think of what the relationship is between a focus on information and disinformation as a consequence in that context of like a legitimacy crisis.
Yeah, I think one interesting thing in a survey I did recently where I asked people to write the first thing that came to mind when they thought of climate change. Actually, the question prompt was the first image. And some people wrote things like melting glaciers or what you might think of as an image. But a lot of people just wrote misinformation, hoax, lies, fraud. Mm. And there's this whole idea about control from elites that came up when people had a space to express things. And it wasn't, you know, people on the left that were concerned about the misinformation. It was coming from a lot of the people who identified as being on the right. So I thought that was really interesting that, you know, everybody across the board is kind of concerned with this legitimacy and the quality of information that's out there.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that is interesting, kind of revealing also that it's a kind of a, as you say, it's kind of across the board. The kind of mistrust, the sense of someone else being in control, right? And if it's across the board, then it does really prompt a question about who is in control, right? And why so much has why as a consequence so much focused on kind of controlling information, because it seems maybe more more controllable, more tangible, something which is an easier entry point for kind of making a political impact.
Yeah, that's why I called it a cheap hack, which people reacted to, but I meant it in the sense of somebody who's been studying techno fixes for many years. Like, it reminded me of geoengineering in that way, where it's like this maybe algorithmic or, you know, other sort of institutional fix for a deeper problem that actually we should be thinking about the roots of.
You draw on some parallels with combating anti-vaccine and other disinformation during the pandemic, and that ultimately backfired and actually led to some further deterioration in trust in elites and health institutions, potentially, as you put it, leaving us even worse off ahead of the next pandemic. So why is this the case? And maybe you could talk a little bit more about how disinformation campaigns end up sort of marrying with this condescension, where and treating people as fodder for, as I said, mentioned earlier, the ad men, and is actually ultimately counterproductive to what we want to be achieving with respect to a healthy discourse.
Yeah, but I think COVID really laid bare the problems of our sense-making institutions, especially in terms of exploring trade-offs or thinking about nuance. And we saw some patterns where, you know, things became polarized very quickly. Things like mask wearing, we saw different reversals of policy. We saw different sorts of stigmas around it in different ways. And no matter what side of these things you're on, I think people could agree that our response to COVID left a lot of things lacking and was suboptimal. So I think that had spillover effects actually on climate, because you had a segment of the population that felt like their concerns about vaccine efficacy or information about the vaccines, as well as, you know, scientific evidence for masks or whatever, in many ways, their informational needs were not being met. And so that same population who's been concerned about that is now concerned about the idea of climate lockdowns or, you know, so-called other authoritarian measures that would be used to deal with climate change. So we definitely see a spillover effect. And from our experience with COVID, I think the way to deal with people who have these concerns is not to stigmatize them as being victims of misinformation or try to regulate the information landscape at that algorithmic level. I think it's to get to their deeper questions and have an honest dialogue and try to answer them.
But I mean, what would you say actually, as you prompted it, someone who would who is afraid of climate lockdowns? I mean, my co-host on this podcast is himself concerned that will be the next stage in dealing with climate change, that some form of, you know, authoritarian restriction on movement will be introduced as a way of kind of responding to climate change without doing the kind of as a kind of an easy, a cheap cut to like not having to deal with, to actually do the hard decarbonization work, for example, you know, just stop people flying, stop people traveling, etc.
Yeah, I think that's a conversation we need to have and think about what trade-offs are ethical, what the asks really are. Like, there's this whole degrowth literature where they've developed different scenarios, like a low energy demand scenario. And you see in these scenarios, if you read the supplementary information, modeling assumptions around things like how many meters squared living space each person would have in this model. And then those models are used to make arguments about what kind of future is preferable. And I think, you know, we should say, great, let's have a conversation. How would we get to 15 or 30 meters squared living space per person? What sort of political arrangements allow for that? Is, you know, be very transparent about the assumptions. And then, you know, do those things require a climate lockdown? Or, you know, what's the mechanism of action? I think that conversations around these things, rather than burying them in models, would be really useful right now.
There's two, sort of two concepts here, both in your essay and in the wider context, between sort of climate disinformation and so-called climate denial. That is to say, denying that anthropogenic global warming is real. Or, as in a new book that you reference in your piece, by Tad DeLay, which is a bit of an ironic name there, and a report on artificial intelligence and climate denial, they argue that there is a quote-unquote new denial, that doesn't deny global warming anymore, but involves narratives that climate solutions don't work, or that climate science and the climate movement are unreliable. And so online platforms are being called on to de-amplify this new kind of denial content. So now in your piece, you argue that this doesn't work in practice, but also more importantly, it's sort of epistemically worrying. And maybe you could explain why. How does this all fit in with the incentive structures of the online outrage industrial complex? Or again, as you quote addiction expert David Courtright, what he calls limbic capitalism.
Yeah, well, there's a lot in that question. So I was very worried when I first started seeing this redefinition of climate denial as into rejecting certain types of climate solutions, because one of the examples of this report that got some amount of traction, which was from the Center for Countering Digital Hate about the new climate denial, you know, had this example where they were talking about this idea that renewables can do it all. And if you think nuclear power needs to be part of baseload, then you're part of this new climate denial. I'm like, wait a minute, that's a very live debate around, you know, people who work on energy systems. We need to have that conversation. You can't just rebrand that conversation as denial. Another example in that report was a conversation on YouTube between Jordan Peterson, who I'm not a fan of, just to be very clear, and the premier of Alberta. And it's like, okay, you can't tag that and say that needs to be deplatformed or deamplified, because that's an elected official that's talking about positions that people have. So I think that's, you know, a good conversation to further societal debate. B, you're going to just make this trust issue worse if you start deamplifying certain sorts of content. And it's just really a dead end. And so the same thing came up this week with the New York Times hosting, I don't know if you saw this, some sort of interview series on climate where there's 16 different experts, including this guy from the Heritage Foundation that worked on this project 2025. And there was a huge outcry from people online, the online climate left, saying, hey, what are you doing? You can't platform this guy. And I'm like, well, if he wrote a policy document that could be a policy document that we're stuck with, like, it's relevant. It's in the public interest. And good on the New York Times for, you know, having a serious seasoned reporter interview this guy. So I don't want those things to just be put in a denial box and then like X'd out. Those are conversations that we need to be having as a society.
Yeah, I was kind of like quite angry about, as a Canadian and as somebody who obviously follows the climate discourse quite closely, I was quite frustrated about that, the response to the Jordan Peterson discussion with the Premier of Alberta, because ironically, even though I am no fan of Jordan Peterson either, and the Conservative Premier of Alberta is not who I would be voting for, ironically, she knows this file very well, because, of course, oil and gas is Alberta's biggest export. And a lot of the things that she was putting forward are fairly standard arguments about the difficulty of ensuring a reliable grid, for example, if we only depend upon variable renewables without some other firm source of electricity. If that is now considered to be climate denial or disinformation, then I'm a climate denialist and a climate disinformation propagandist, because I just don't see how we will have a reliable grid without some form of firm, clean electricity. It's almost as if the subject matter itself doesn't matter. It's who was saying this. And so ironically, the people criticizing that, one could say that they are the ones that are engaging in climate disinformation, because they're denying something that is actually true and factual about the difficulty of decarbonizing the electric grid.
I would tend to agree.
Sorry, I guess there wasn't much of a question there.
Well, it gets back to your question that I didn't really answer about the outrage industrial complex. Yeah. And like all of these interactions, you know, they divide a group of people that should be more or less united about climate action for the profit of Elon and guys like him, right? That's who ultimately wins from these sorts of debates.
Yeah, I mean, in thinking about disinformation kind of in a little bit of a broader sense, it seems to me that it's what is your take on why information has become so so central to politics? I mean, my understanding is that kind of the ruling class, and particularly the managers and the managerial strata underneath them, for them, information, facts, knowledge, being smart is critically important. I mean, particularly for the more liberal wing, I think, but maybe for the managerial class as a whole. There's the people who are smart and have the right information, and then there's the people who don't. And then they just need to be informed correctly.
I mean, there's probably a more sophisticated answer that either of you might have, but I'll just speak the thing I know, which is that I think a lot of people genuinely want to do something on climate, but our educational institutions, a lot of them were not, you know, teaching people how to build a wind turbine, right? That's a different type of school, right? So we were producing all these students that go on to want to work on climate, but they don't have hands-on engineering or technical skills. Their thing that they can contribute is, you know, their ideas or their words or whatever thing they can do on a laptop. So I think we just have been producing a lot of these people, and that's what they go on to do.
There's a particularly spicy line in your article along these lines when you write, quote, "If disinformation is the main problem, then the chattering classes are central to the climate fight. But if that's the end of your quote. But if decarbonization is just very, very difficult, physically, biochemically, engineering-wise, infrastructure, and so on and so forth, along the lines of what we're just saying, then these chattering classes just aren't as useful as engineers, chemists, geologists, and even architects. Is what's happened with this discourse just another instance of what sometimes is called physics envy amongst social scientists? And I know you're a social scientist yourself, and I'm a historian. But yeah, run with that one.
I mean, you went out and retrained in something material,
I did, yes.
Right? So like, yeah, I mean, I see it that way, but that might just be because, you know, my positionality, right? I've been thinking a lot about it as a professor who has the responsibility of training the people who are going to continue to deal with climate change. But I also think that there's also a role here with the NGO industrial complex that is also factoring into the dynamics of this in a big way.
I mean, when you've done surveys, have you found people's attitudes expressed in some way with regard to these things, you know, about perhaps maybe the knowledge of how to do things, of how to build things, whatever, versus, I guess the stuff that you were talking about in terms of that Lee mentioned in terms of the role of the, you know, chattering classes?
Well, I mean, when I do focus groups in particular, because we recruit from kind of a cross section of the demographics of the local public, there's a lot of people who work in construction or work in, you know, defense industries, other sorts of things where there's a real material physical component to what they're doing. And I find it really interesting because they have these great questions about the life cycle analysis of different technologies, or, you know, they think about the whole systems approach that would be needed to get these net zero systems online. And so in some ways I've found that the the public maybe knows more about what's going to be necessary to get to net zero than the professionals whose job it is to work on this, which is both scary and heartening in different ways.
Yeah, yeah, I get that, yeah.
Certainly, yeah. I mean, myself as a socialist, I have this fundamental belief that the world as it is built by the working class. The workers know how the world runs, in particular in the sort of industrial, agricultural, and transport systems, and that certainly on the left, we're supposed to be trusting that ordinary people can run, that the grand aim one day is for working people to run society without bosses. What's the old line? The boss needs us, we don't need the boss. I feel quite comfortable with an analysis where ordinary people actually do really know quite a lot about these systems, more than the paid climate professional sometimes. Again, there wasn't really a question there. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, my research is really about going out and asking people questions and listening to their answers. So what do they think is feasible? What benefits do they expect to see? What new harms might they see from different policies or technologies? And it's my hope that that flow of information can continue to be like multi-directional and not just with this expert class who thinks they know what's needed.
Unusually, Jacobin magazine allowed a bit of a back and forth, quite a bit of a back and forth. There was your essay, then there was a piece by former Rhode Island elected representative Aaron Rugenberg, and then you respond. You had a follow up to his follow up. How do you respond to his critique there of your critique? I mean, he says, well, why can't we do both? Can't we chew gum and walk at the same time? Can't we fight disinformation and do the necessary communications work to support the build out of clean energy systems?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I would have thought that myself 5 years ago before I witnessed some of these dynamics. And I think that a lot of people, they were kind of caught up with this idea. Maybe it's a flaw in how I wrote the first piece. But what I was really trying to say is that, no, this whole concept is not leading us anywhere good. It leads us down this path of everything being an information war where we might not like the results, and it's the wrong conceptual frame, and you know, we'll provoke this backlash from people if we carry it forward. And I think it's nice to believe we could do all of it, but it's not addressing the main argument about the flaws in the concept and the language.
And I'm always kind of interested in the sort of personal aspect of this, because so much of the climate discourse has become so personalized. I myself have felt that. Perhaps I'm sometimes too online with this. How did you feel about this back and forth and the response, particularly for some fairly high profile climate personalities, you might say? Did it burn you out a little bit? Was it frustrating? Did it enrage you? Did you begin to participate in the outrage industrial complex?
Well, I think the most basic thing, if you're in any kind of position where you mentor students, you have to teach them to critique ideas and not people, because otherwise you don't have a society anymore, actually. Like, the whole project is that we're supposed to be critiquing each other's ideas to produce new and better knowledge. And if that cycle breaks down, then like, what are you even doing? So my personal feelings aside, I, you know, have to focus on what I think, like the guy who wrote the response, I'm sure is a really enthusiastic climate champion, right? So great. You know, I'm glad that we could have an exchange, and I'm glad that Jacobin could publish in exchange. And I'm just trying to focus on that rather than, you know, the various people online who called me a petro mercenary or whatever.
That sounds cool. Petro mercenary. Yeah, that sounds...
Well, you're very generous, much more generous than I think I would be.
I mean, this has all been fascinating. I wanted to give you an opportunity as well, Holly, to for those who might be interested amongst our listeners to check out your books. What the argument is that you present in After Geoengineering as well as in Ending Fossil Fuels.
Yeah, well, After Geoengineering, which, you know, I wrote most of in 2018, and technology changes, but actually it's still pretty relevant. It's basically was a call for the left to engage with this topic in a serious way. Like, if you care about climate change, if you think it's a serious threat, like I do, the fate of these approaches is going to be really important. And so we should be weighing in about how to develop them rather than just rejecting them out of a sense of purity or whatever. Then Ending Fossil Fuels, that book I wrote during the pandemic in 2020. And that was already, it was kind of a different time because at that time, it really seemed like we were in this wave of net zero targets. It seemed like climate action was going to be a thing. We've kind of crested from that wave, I think. There's been a lot of challenges with inflation, with financing projects, with backlash to ESG, different sorts of, you know, big issues that have come up in the macro space. But at that time, I was, you know, saying, A, we can't just rely on scaling clean energy. We have to think about how to discontinue this infrastructure, and it needs to happen in a planned way. And B, net zero is not enough as like the big frame for climate policy. We need to evolve other sorts of goals and language. And so it was really hoping that other people would write more books about ending fossil fuels. Like, it's insane that we don't have dozens of books about how to do this, or a whole field of study and discontinuation studies that thinks about how to discontinue other things that are causing harm. And so I'm disappointed and scared, frankly, that not more people have taken on this idea of ending fossil fuels in like a serious intellectual road mapping, doing the math, figuring out what we're going to do to phase them out. It's mind-boggling to me that we haven't made more progress on this.
Well, I mean, I'd be interested myself in hearing more about that, and it does seem a lot more of a productive way of going about things than stamping your feet and saying, just stop. Or for that matter, stamping your feet and saying, I'm not interested, I'm not paying attention. It's all too difficult. So that all sounds fascinating. Thank you, Holly, for coming on and discussing this with us.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.